welcome all of you this morning. Would please, as we're beginning, if you would turn to Job chapter 30. Now, in the first hour, I gave a little bit of a preview, a little bit of a review to make sure that you see where we're coming into this. And I want to do this today. When you get to Job chapter 28, you find three chapters back to back, maybe four, but at least three chapters back to back, each one independent and separate from the others, but I think interconnected. In chapter 28, Job suddenly seems to turn from the other things he's been talking about, and he begins to talk about a fact that he finds curious. Human beings alone, of all the created order, human beings seem to have figured out how to find things that no living thing in creation seems to be able to find, and yet human beings can find it. They seem to know how to dig in the earth and where to dig to find silver and gold and precious stones. Lions have never walked there, it says. Birds of prey can't see it. But they, human beings, have figured out how to find those things. But nobody seems to know how to find wisdom. And he concludes that chapter with the powerful words, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. The avoidance of evil is the beginning of understanding. Now, I want to step off of that and go back to chapter 1. Job doesn't know anything about what happened in chapter 1. God is on his throne. He's in attendance are his angels, and either with them or among them is Satan. And what does God say to Satan? Where have you been? That's the first thing he says, where have you been? And Satan says, walking around on earth, roaming around from here to there. Who mentions Job first? God does. And somebody, sitting roughly where Barbara is sitting this morning, pointed out, it's almost like God said, there's a target. Now, I want to pause for just a second. There's a cartoonist named Gary Larson who did about 6 or 8 years of cartoons called Farside. Did you guys ever read Farside cartoons? Warped mentality clearly in this. One of the cartoons I clearly remember, two deer standing side by side, not on four legs, but up like this. Okay, and the one deer has dark on the outside and white down the middle. Second deer, dark on the outside, white down the middle. But right about here was a big black circle, inside a little smaller black circle, down the middle a big black dot. And the deer over here looks at the one that has this and says, bummer of a birthmark, Hal. Remember that cartoon? You almost get the feeling that God put Job in Satan's crosshairs. And that these things may be happening because somehow God needed them to happen. I don't know where to go with that thought, because the death of his children seems to be something that doesn't fit at all. But somehow God was drawing Satan's attention to this particular guy. Yes, ma'am. You seem to have something.
You said something. I missed it.
How quick it goes by.
So fast. On the other end of where you first started, that little last little bit. What'd you say?
I have no idea.
Me neither. It'll be about
2 minutes back. I said several things. I don't know which one you're looking for. All of a sudden, bad things start happening to Job. His children die. His possessions are stolen and taken away from him. His health collapses. And he doesn't know where it's coming from. But we do. God says to Satan, have you noticed my servant Job? And what's the next thing he says? Two words, pick three or four translations and you'll have a total of 6 or 8 words. And one of those 8 words is blameless. What are some of the others? Pure, honest, upright, righteous. And then says, he fears God and shuns evil. The end of chapter 28 is an echo of that, and I don't think Job recognizes it. How could he? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The avoidance of evil is the beginning of understanding. If it's not that, it's close to that. So that's chapter 28. What was chapter 29? This is what we talked about last week, and our friends weren't here, so we need to catch them up on this, right? I don't think you were here last week, so we need to catch you up. What was the subject of chapter 29?
Right, his own, putting forth his own righteousness.
Well, not quite. That's pretty subtle. We got there, but the first glimpse of chapter 29, he's remembering what life used to be like before the roof fell in. And he begins to talk about all the things he did, and they are wonderful things to have done. He helped the poor. He defended widows and orphans. Every one of them, wonderful things to have done. But as you start reading it, and this is what we did last time, you start to get a sense there's a false note or two in here. What was the first false note? What was the evidence that gave us the sense of a false note? It was, he's saying, I and me and my a whole lot. Now, one of the cool things about an electronic version of Scripture is that you can do some highlighting. In this particular one, I can highlight with four different colors. So I have highlighted all the way down to verse 10 in yellow. And then in pink, I have put the words I and me and my and me and I. And it's just scattered with this. I long for the years gone by when God took care of me, when he lit up the way before me, and I walked safely through the darkness, when I was in my prime, and God's friendship was felt in my home, when my children were around me, my cows produced milk in abundance, my groves poured out streams. You have to look carefully to see that, but there seems to be a false note in there somewhere. You get down to verse 11, And the false note begins to... Mine is stuck right now. There we go. You begin in verse 11 to hear a second false note that's a little bigger than the first one. What's that? I do good things for people, and they praise me. They speak well of me. They bless me. We took some time and went over to Corinthians, and what did we see over there? When you do good things for people, what should happen? They should praise God because of what you've done. That's a false note. You come down to verse 18 and you see the third false note. What's that? I thought, surely I will die surrounded by my family after a long good life. I am in chapter 29 and I'm at verse 18. There's a presumption there. And we spent some time talking about presumption. I've had a moment or two that I thought were pretty spectacular, and I shared a couple of those with you. And I think I shared with you that in the first hour when we talked about this, a guy came up afterwards and talked about that he was in the military, scheduled to go home to end his military service, go back to the inactive reserves, and go to graduate school. He's actually a chemist or chemical engineer. Everything was set. They were coming for his furniture on Wednesday, and he was gone. His original time for discharge was October 5, and he had gotten special permission from the Pentagon somehow to leave on September 27 or 28. There were some reasons that worked better, and the Pentagon finally said okay. And all of a sudden, the Berlin Wall went up, and it was announced that everybody whose end of service is October 1 or later is automatically re-upped for 1 year, and you have no choice about it. And then the discussion was, well, your end date is October 5, but you got this special approval for September 27. One of them lets you go, one of them doesn't. And he spent a week not knowing which way it was. But he had assumed everything was okay, and then suddenly the roof fell in. There's a hint of presumption in there. Now, what's chapter 30 talking about?
It seems that the way people look at him now, the way people are treating him now,
Yeah. Now, after the roof has fallen in, what's my life like? And that's where we're headed. That's where we're headed now. The roof has fallen in. Chapter 30 for me starts with the words, but now. Does yours have those as either the first words or something equivalent?
Yes.
But now. That's a pretty powerful statement. I'm mocked by people younger than I, by young men whose fathers were not worthy to run with my sheepdogs. A lot of good they are to me, these worn out wretches. Comes down to verse 8, and he has some wonderful names to describe them. What are the names? Mine says they are nameless fools. I think one translation says fatherless, which if you don't have a father, your father can't give you a name. Right? Outcast from society. And now they mock me with vulgar songs, taunt me. They despise me and won't come near me except to spit in my face. Verse 15, I live in terror now. My honor has blown away in the wind, and my prosperity has vanished like a cloud. There is another translation out there that's better. Do you have a better translation at that spot? Somebody in the first hour did. I just jumped down to verse 15. My translation, the one I'm looking at here, my honor has blown away in the wind. I live in terror now. My honor has blown away in the wind, and my prosperity has vanished like a cloud. But that's not the best translation. Somebody's got a better one.
Terrors are turned upon me.
Mm-hmm.
My dignity is driven away.
Okay, that's not it yet. Yes, sir.
I like the latter part of the NIV. It says, my safety vanishes like a cloud.
Yeah. Here's the other translation I've seen, and somebody else had something like this morning. Terror rounds on me. My confidence is dispersed as though by the wind. My hope of safety vanishes like a cloud. Confidence and hope is gone. I think that's a better translation right in there. Verse 16, now my life seeps away. Depression haunts my days. Verse 17, at night my bones are filled with pain, which gnaws at me relentlessly. Verse 20, I cry to you, O God, but you don't answer. I stand before you, but you don't even look. Verse 22, you throw me into the whirlwind and destroy me in the storm, and I know you're sending me to my death, the destination of all who live. Verse 25, did I not weep for those in trouble? Was I not deeply grieved for the needy? Verse 26, so I looked for good, but evil came instead. I waited for the light, but darkness fell. Verse 28, I walk in gloom without sunlight. I stand in the public square and cry for help, but instead I'm considered a brother to jackals and a companion to owls. I know your translation may say ostriches at that point, but I like owls better. And I don't know which one it ought to be. Verse 31, my heart plays sad music, and my flute accompanies those who weep. Chapter 28. People know how to find all kinds of things that nobody ever knew how to find. But do they know how to find wisdom? Chapter 29. This is the way it used to be. A couple of false notes hiding in there. Chapter 30, this is how it is now. Then you get to chapter 31. And I want to show you the structure of chapter 31 first, and then I want to try to help you understand what I think it's saying. Chapter 31 begins to make a list, kind of like what you saw in chapter 29, of things he has done. But the way he emphasizes is it a little different. The first verse is powerful. Every man alive ought to know this verse. What does he say? There's one translation out there that I think gets it right, and I don't have that translation in front of me. I made a covenant with my eyes not to let my eyes linger on a beautiful young woman.
Lustfully.
Yeah.
Lustfully.
Yeah. The word linger, I think, is the one that seems to me, you know, you notice somebody walking by, but you make a covenant with your eyes, you don't take that second look. He's avoiding evil, right? Now, come on down with me, and I want to show you this. Verse 5. Have I lied to anyone? Have I deceived anyone? Let God weigh me on the scale of justice. He knows my integrity. Now, verse 7 is the one that I want you to see, because I think this is the place where it's most clear what he's doing. I find the word if 3 times in that verse. Do you? If I've done this, if I've done that, if I've done the other, and how does verse 8 start? Then. Now, what is an if-then proposition? That particular structure in our language, what does that suggest? If I'm guilty of this and this and this, then I deserve this and this and that. You okay so far? That's the structure he's using. And you can put pretty much the rest of the chapter into that same structure if you want to. It doesn't always say it that way. But he's basically making an argument. I don't deserve all the suffering that I'm getting. Why not? Because I haven't done this and I have done that. Right?
Yes.
And Job doesn't see that. There's one more false note. And that's the false note that I think emerges from chapter 31. And I gotta stick here for a minute or two to try to help you see what I'm talking about. Job is saying over and over again to the frustration of his friends, I am blameless, or words that are like that. What was God's comment to Satan way back in chapter 1? Job never heard this. But what was God's comment? He is upright, honest, pure, blameless, fears God, shuns evil. So God agrees with that, right? What is the foundation on which that assertion rests? What is it that stands as the foundation on which Job can stand and say, I am blameless? Well, what's happening in chapter 29 and here in chapter 31 is something else is emerging. I don't deserve what's happened to me because I have done these things and I have not done those things. Therefore, I don't deserve this. And that is precisely the argument that his friends have been making and he's been rejecting. And I don't think he can see that. What is the basis on which he can make that claim?
That he's done all of it. He's reconciled all those issues. Mm-hmm. In whatever way.
That's not the basis. My hope is based on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly lean on his holy name.
And as you said, many times, you know that, but how did he?
Somehow he figured that out. But what I'm saying is, by the time you get to chapter 29 and 31, he's lost track of that. If he's blameless, what does that mean? I need to take you somewhere. When salvation comes, what brought salvation to you? Jesus' death on the cross. And it redeemed all of eternity, backwards and forwards. That's what the message of the New Testament taught. That's the good news. Right?
Yeah.
Therefore, the things we do or don't do, why do we do or not do them? It's not to earn the status of blamelessness. It's what? It's gratitude for what God has done. And Job has lost sight of that. That's the false note in 31. It's wonderful that he hasn't done these terrible things. It's wonderful that he has done all these good things. But he's lost track of his own argument.
Garden, that's what happened. You have it all. You know me. You have my blessings. But what? I don't know this.
Yeah.
You know?
I tried to say it this way in the first hour. See if this works. Salvation comes to us. And in a moment in time, when we accept Him into our hearts, when we accept God's Spirit into our hearts, we are freed at that moment and forever from the penalty of sin. But from there and for the rest of our lives is a process in which we are being freed. A little more if we work with Him, a little less if we don't. We are being freed from the power of sin. And when we all meet in heaven, we are finally freed from the presence of sin. Here's where we live our lives. Is He blameless? Yes. Because of what He's done? No. He's blameless because He has taken God's righteousness as shown in Jesus and covered His sin. But that process of removing Him from the power of sin, that's still going on. And what you see, I think, in chapter 29 and chapter 31, false notes. It's all about me. People are blessing me. I assumed that I'd be able to live like this the rest of our lives. And I don't understand why this happened to me. If I'd done this, I could understand it. If I'd done that, I could understand it. But I haven't done those things. If I'd done this, then sure. And the message seems to be that Job is actually claiming his friend's argument. That you don't suffer if you've done the right things. You do suffer if you've done the wrong things. And Job had it, but he lost sight of it. Is this making sense for you?
Yeah, it is. To me, it's the works mentality. Isn't it?
I think I see it here. That I am claiming I shouldn't be suffering all these things because of the things I've done or haven't done. And it has that false note in it. Now, here's my question. Job is one of the best people in the moral sense of things that the world has ever seen. But Job still needs God's ongoing salvation. And it almost looks like God has said, okay, let's take a good look at that. Do you remember that section in Corinthians? I keep taking you back there every once in a while. Paul says, I built a foundation like a master craftsman. And there's no foundation you can build other than the one I built as I was leading you to salvation, he says. Now, once that foundation is built, that's salvation in Christ. Then each person has to build on that. And some people build with, this is your moment, you need to remember now. Or they build with, those are the two things I'm looking for. You remember this moment? Some build with gold and silver and precious stones. And others build with hay and wood and straw. And there's a day during the dawn in fire and it's going to test the quality of people's work. You build in gold and silver and precious stones, metaphorically, and they get more precious as fire comes to it. But you build in hay and wood and straw, what's going to happen? They'll be burned up. And he says, the ones whose work is burnt down, they'll be saved, but they'll be saved like you expect to be saved from a fire. Do you guys get calendars at the first of every year? Picture up here and then a block for each day down here.
Well, there's some calendars back there.
Turn the page, there's a new picture and all that. Okay, somewhere in my archives, it's about this big, I have a page out of a calendar from way back when. It was a Charlie Brown calendar. And this particular page shows Charlie Brown speaking with Linus. And he looks at Linus and he says, when you die and go to heaven, are you graded pass-fail or are you graded on a curve? Do you know the answer to that question? I think it's vital that you know the answer to that question. And it fits right here. You know the answer?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Sounds like a curve.
You think a curve? You think pass-fail?
Pass-fail.
How many votes for pass-fail? How many votes for curve? Did you notice anything? My hand stayed up for both of them.
Oh.
Pass-fail is that moment of salvation. The curve is beyond that. And you read in the New Testament, it says there are rewards coming that are graded on what you did. Okay? Over in Revelation, there's a picture of judgment. God sits on his great white throne, and in front of him are the dead. The dead, the dead, the dead, the dead, the dead, the dead. All through there, the word the dead keeps coming. And they are judged. Here's the book of life. All the things they've ever done are in the book of life. Are they judged based on that? Nope. There's this other book. That's called the book of life. Over here, the question is only, is your name in the book? That book is irrelevant. It's there, but it's irrelevant. It's this book. Are you? Is you, if your name is in the book of life, you're not there. Because if you're in the book of life, you're not dead, you're alive. Paul said at one point, said to the Gentiles, you were dead. And then he looks at himself, because he's Jewish, he says, so were we. But God brought us all to life in Christ Jesus. The great white judgment is not for us. That's for the dead. You're alive. But there is a judgment for you. And it's over in one of Paul's letters. It says there's the judgment seat of Christ. And at the judgment seat of Christ, you're going to be seen for what you are. Would you like to gulp real strongly right there? What are you? I thought it was Ephesians 5:9, but somebody else this morning said it was Ephesians 2:10. It says, you are God's work of art, created in Christ Jesus for good works. The good works are gratitude. Not the ticket price. You are graded pass fail, dead or alive. Then you're graded on the curve. What have you done with the life God gave you? You're God's work of art. What did you let God do in your life? What has God's Spirit been able to produce in your life? Jesus puts his arm around me and says, look at what we were able to do in spite of the fact that you're stubborn and opinionated. You at least let the Spirit work here. You at least let the Spirit work there. Look what we did with that. You're saved. But you might be saved if somebody's saved from a fire. I think that's all hiding in here. Okay? Tell me what the last few words are in chapter 31.
The words of Job ended.
Job, at this point, quits talking. What's the first verse of chapter 32?
These three men stopped answering Job.
Job quits talking.
Everybody's talked out.
His three friends won't talk. Why won't his friends talk?
Because he's righteous in his own eyes.
Because he kept insisting on his own innocence, mine says. Is he blameless? Is he pure? Is he honest? You bet he is. But those false notes are suggesting something. Somebody in the first hour said they had a footnote right there. Yours actually seems to have that translation. Would you read that one more time?
Just
32, verse 1.
So these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes.
That's a different way of translating that. But I think that picks up the false notes from chapter 29. Chapter 31 picks up the false notes. Now, at this particular point, I want to remind you of something that I said the first day we started talking about Job. I believe this happened contemporaneous with or earlier than Abraham. And I think there's an oral tradition that has existed with people telling this story down through the years. And finally, somewhere much later, somebody wrote this down as we have it. And I think they intended for it to be presented as a stage play. It's not a stage play in the sense of all the words are made up. And it's telling a story that I think has existed, but it was recorded in a way that... So I want you to think of yourselves as the audience. And up here are Job and his three friends, maybe a narrator to start you off. And we've been watching the play. And all of a sudden, at this moment, maybe from that seat... Maybe from that seat back there. Maybe from this one. Somebody stands up and begins to speak. Have you been to a play like that? You ever seen this happen? The place you've most likely seen this is called flash mobs. And YouTube will show them. Somebody with a cello walks into the middle of a big open square with people going all the way across it, sits down and starts to play a couple of notes. And from over here, somebody walks out with a trumpet. And over here, somebody walks out with something else. And all of a sudden, the musicians are gathering. And then suddenly, maybe from a balcony overlooking this thing, the singers begin to sing. And all of a sudden, Handel's Messiah is going full blown. And you were just standing in the middle of this, and suddenly it happens. Right? It changes everything at this moment. Somebody in the crowd has been sitting with you all this time, watching, suddenly stands up and starts to walk out and begins to argue with the people on the stage. What's his name? Verse 2. Elihu. It tells us that he was younger than the three friends. It tells us that in his mind he deferred to them. But now that everybody was shutting up, he says, I have to talk. There's a problem. There's a false note here. What is his attitude, his state of mind? Verse 2 tells you.
Angry.
That doesn't sound like a godly person speaking. There's a false note. There's a few commentators who use that piece to argue that he was expressing Satan's point of view. I don't buy that. I don't buy that for a minute, but I will tell you, if you read a spread of commentators, you'll see that coming up from a few places. Because he is angry, and that doesn't sound very godly. They also seem to pick up on a few of the things that he says. But in any event, he begins to speak. Chapter 33, he's still speaking. Chapter 34, he's still speaking. Chapter 35, he's still speaking. Chapter 36, he's still speaking. Chapter 37, he's still speaking. This guy gets six chapters. Chapter 32 to chapter 37. He gets six chapters. That's a lot of chapters. So we need to look at what this guy's saying. What's our problem? This was the point where I ran out of time in the first hour. So what's your job? To read the rest of Job. Focused on...
But you've got 10 minutes.
Chapter 32. No, I'm not going to take you off and leave them behind. I'm going to keep you on the same tool. Okay. As long as I do have 10 minutes, I'll give you this little clue. As you're reading through, there are two very different things that are happening. One is what he is saying. And two is what is happening around him as he says it. And the second is much, much harder to spot. So my challenge is, as you read this, can you spot those two things?
Happening around him, meaning Job?
Here's Elihu. Here's the stage play. He has stepped out of his seat. And so it would be like you standing up and just suddenly starting. You know, I'm sitting there. I've said everything I can say, and I go and I sit down, and all of a sudden Raz stands up, or Rusty stands up, or maybe you stand up, or maybe Barbara stands up. You suddenly take over, and you take over for a long time, and you're saying all kinds of things. Right? And as you're saying those things, there's stuff happening around you as the audience, and it's hinted at in his words. And I want to see if you can see that. What's the last chapter of Job? You're looking, right? Yeah. What's the last chapter of Job?
42.
What's the last chapter of Elihu? 37. So we got a few more chapters past Elihu for somebody else to have a chance to talk. I'll just leave it like that. Let me come back to this for just a minute. What happens on Thursday of this week? We celebrate Christmas. What is the essence of Christmas? God himself came into our world, first in the form of a baby, and then in the form of a grown man. And in that process, he let us understand who God is in a way that it couldn't have happened any other way. God came to be with us. And that's what the baby represents. Easter is the bookend. we see the other end of this 33-year story of God himself coming into our world. Where does Job's hope rest? It rests on God coming into this world. And back in the middle of all these things Job has been saying, he found that, but he lost it. I know that my Redeemer lives. And that when all is done and my body is dust, I'll be back in my body and I will know my Redeemer face to face. He was there. But somehow, as it got further and further into this, he's come back to, well, I've earned. No. God has given us a gift. What did I say last week, if you were here? Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. The one talks about Jesus' humanity, the other speaks of Jesus' divinity. You always want to take those two things together. And out of gratitude, all the things that Job is doing should be the ideal of what we do. And we won't be able to match Job. Job is almost matchless in that regard, I think. That's one reason that God said, "Do you know this, my servant Job? That's about as good as you get until I come and I'm with him." And then there's a whole new dimension that people find. Everything is right about what Job did, but he lost track of why. And that's as much as I think I can do today. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Sorry. Yeah.